Okay, if you'd like to take your seats and then turn to, I don't know what colour this is, salmon maybe, salmon coloured sheets. We're up to number four in our Bible overview, and tonight, as I said, we're looking at the books of Joshua and Judges. And the plan for this evening is we're going to do an overview, so we're going to quickly overview both of those two books. Then we're going to share communion together, and then we're going to look at Joshua chapter 2, one particular passage from the whole section. If you need some more of these, John, I think there's plenty at the back. There's a whole lot left over. And there's some more Bibles at the back as well. Yeah. So first of all, we're going to do an overview of Joshua and Judges. Just to remind you, so the Bible is one book with one message that we're thinking about, but it's also, of course, 66 books, and the way we're trying to follow it is roughly chronologically, but also in sections of literature. So we're keeping, for example, the poetry together, the law together, and the history together. And this is part of the history, Joshua and Judges. And also to remind you, a little bit like the moon that is always there all the time, but some of the time we can see more of it than others. Throughout the Bible, God's plans are progressive, they're unfolding. You see more and more of them. And so each week we're looking for trajectories. And I suppose the theme for tonight is land. We're going to be thinking a lot about God's land, and we're plotting the trajectory of God's land throughout the Bible. Right, now if I've got my notes, let's talk it through. There'll be a bit of discussion, time for questions as well. So, the first thing, and we saw this in Genesis, when Colin looked through particularly the patriarchs, Abraham, Jacob, Isaac, and so on, that there was a theme there. You notice that the promise was passed on from one father to son and so forth. And we don't have time to look it up, but for example, Genesis 17 and Genesis 28, again and again, part of the promise was not just a spiritual promise, but geographical land was part of the promise. Now, why is it so important? Well, we don't have time. We're now on the front of these sheets. Don't have time to go through it all. You can check it up for yourself at home if you want to. The land was important because it was God's land. There are echoes of Eden. It's a little bit like God's promised area for people, his people to live in. God cares for this land like he did for Eden. It is given as a gift of inheritance and something that is a theme that's picked up for the future. It's also a place of God's rest. Now, I don't know if you want to grab a Bible and just turn to Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7. We don't have time to read the whole passage. If you want to look at verses 7 and 8. One question that appears, obviously, we're going to be thinking about again and again. All of this seems very unfair, doesn't it? Why does God give one bit of land to one group of people and tell all the others to get lost? It seems unfair. Is God unfair in choosing the Israelites? Was it something special about the Israelites? Well, does someone just want to read out verses 7 and 8 of Deuteronomy 7? And then we'll think about, was God fair? Anybody brave enough to... Yeah, go on, Pat.
The Lord did not set his affection on you and choose you because you were more numerous than other peoples, for you were the fewest of all peoples. But it was because the Lord loved you and kept the oath he swore to your ancestors that he brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the land of slavery from the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt.
Thanks, Pat. So, thanks, Pat. So, what reason? Why did God choose the Israelites?
He loved them.
Because he loved them. And what, George? Why did he love them?
It's not what I deserve. Hang on, to your question.
No. Exactly. Why did God love them? Because he loved them. There's no explanation. The passage is very clear. It's not because there was anything special about them. It wasn't as if it's choosing. You know, when if you were at school and you were the last one to be picked when they were picking sides, you thought, oh. We tend to think of choosing in that sense, that choosing them means, oh, well, I'm choosing them because they're better. Well, don't get rid of those ideas of choosing. It's not that kind of choosing. The reason God chose Israel to have this land was not for any reason other than he chose them. He chose them because he loved them. Why did he love them? Because he's love. We don't fully understand that. So, why this focus on the land? Here's a couple of maps for you. So first of all, we've seen how God saved his people from Egypt. So they wandered around that bit in the middle of the map for about 40 years. And now they're approaching the promised land. Now, can you see, if you look at the map, that it would have been a lot easier just to come up from the south, wouldn't it? But, and exactly why, I don't know. God in his purposes chose them to come round the Dead Sea, that blue bit at the bottom of Israel, and they're now going to approach from the other side, as it were. So can you see that? Tonight we're going to be thinking particularly about Jericho. What God's people have done, in effect, I know Egypt's down here, but they've come round and they're about to cross the River Jordan. Jericho is the first city you come to. So if you're coming from east to west into that bit of land, Jericho acts very much like a gate entry point. It's the sort of the first point you come to. You're coming into what we would call the promised land. And then that's just a map of how the 12 tribes of Israel, after all this, portion up the land. Right, so why was the land so important? Well, we've seen it was part of the promise that God gave to his people. And we've also seen, remember, all the way back from the Garden of Eden, that when people return to God, they are coming from the east towards God west. Not there's anything magic about east-west. It's just symbol-laden language. So, having seen all that, let's actually look at the two books. The book of Joshua is divided up very simply. The first 10 chapters, it's about the conquest of the south of the land. The next two chapters about the conquest of the north. And then finally, dividing them up. Now, in a way that we don't fully understand, because our culture is quite different, the land gave something tangible to the promises of God. There's a sense in which the land is described as inheritance. It's a sense in which each tribe gets a parcel of land, almost as if the land is saying this is a bit of God. Almost. I don't want to push that too far, but in their very tangible culture where they think of physical things, possessions, by giving the land and parceling it up, it was saying that actually God is with us. We've got part of his land. Now that's going to become very significant because, of course, the exile, therefore, is catastrophic for the people because to leave the land is almost as if you're leaving God. Another thing to notice, of course, is these themes that go throughout the Bible. Joshua is another deliverer. So after Moses, God sends Joshua to lead his people. Joshua, his name literally means the Lord saves. That's a Hebrew word. Anybody know what that word is if you translate it into Greek? Yeah, Jesus. So Jesus, Joshua, they're exactly the same name. Just one's a Hebrew name and one's a Greek name. That's all. So you've got sort of a pattern here. You'll be time for questions in a moment. One question you might want to think about is the whole process of the land. We struggle with this, obviously. It feels like genocide that God is told Joshua just to kick all the people out of the land. Of course, that's something we find hard. One thing we've got to think about, though, if ever we were going to apply it today, is the move in thinking about history. So back in the Old Testament, God had given very specific instructions to his people that they were following out, connected to the land. That all changes in the New Testament. In the book of Acts, the gospel is no longer geographically bound. Quite the opposite. Now, it's not inward call to a land. It's outward to all four corners of the world. So we don't believe in a theocracy in the way the Israelites did. I know some British people like to think that the empire was part of God's kingdom, but we don't believe that God favours this nation in a particular way above other nations. So I would say it would be impossible to apply this kind of sense of God saying to a nation, you've got to go out and take out another nation again. But anyway, I'm just deliberately stirring up some thoughts. If you want some questions, come back to me later. So that's Joshua. The book of Judges. Yeah, sorry, I've gone on to that. So the idea that land is a piece of God, that God is faithful, that his people aren't. Here's a question for you to think about. Would somebody, well, yeah, somebody like to read Joshua 17, verses 12 to 13? Just shout out when you get to it. Joshua 17, verses 12 to 13.
I'll read it.
Thanks.
Yet the Manassites were not able to occupy its towns, for the Canaanites were determined to live in that region. However, when the Israelites grew stronger, they subjected the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not drive them out completely. The people of Joseph said to Joshua, "Why have you given us only one allotment and one portion for an inheritance? We are a numerous people, and the Lord has blessed us abundantly." "If you are so numerous," Joshua answered, "and if the hill country of Ephraim is too small for you, go up into the forest and clear land for yourselves there, in the land of the Perizzites and the Rephaites.
Yeah.
The people of Joseph replied, "The hill country is not enough for us, and all the Canaanites who live in the plain have iron chariots, but those in Beth Shan and its settlements, and those in the both those in Beth Shan and its settlements, and those in the valley of Jezreel." But Joshua said to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, the hill country as well.
Okay, good. Thanks. Can you just want to stop there? So the main point I want you to take out is that they weren't able to drive all these nations out. They tried, but they weren't able. Would somebody else then turn to chapter 21, verses 43 to 45? So we just read in 17, and I could have given you lots of other verses. They weren't able to drive the people out. Someone else want to read chapter 21, verses 43 to 45.
I will join if you want.
Yep, please.
So the Lord gave all Israel all the land he had sworn to give their ancestors, and they took possession of it and settled there. The Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their ancestors. Not one of their enemies withstood them. The Lord gave all their enemies into their hands. Not one of all the Lord's good promises to Israel failed. Every one was fulfilled.
So, Collins just read, every single promise was fulfilled. How do we square that with the fact that Morris just read, and I could give you lots of other verses, that actually they didn't conquer all of the land? How do we put those two things together? So you read throughout the book of Joshua, and again it says, they tried, but the people were too strong. They couldn't push them out. And then you come to the end, and Colin reads, all the land was conquered, all God's promises were answered. How do we square those two together?
Is it God's plan?
Well, yes, part of God's plan. Any other sort of thoughts and comments?
The promises were always conditional, weren't they?
Yeah, the promises were conditional. And Ian?
I think the people were a bit lazy at times, and they weren't very faithful.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, to put it very simplistically, what that teaches us is they're both true. God was faithful. All of the promises he made were true. But his people weren't. He kept saying, off you go, and they didn't. And we're going to come up to that again and again and again. So that's Joshua. Then we move on to the book of Judges. You want to turn to Judges chapter 2 and just have chapter 2 in front of you. That describes what happens once, but actually we could use this as a summary of the whole book of Judges because it's a pattern that happens again and again and again. So the story begins with God's people at peace. Everything's going very well. The next thing that happens is that the people turn away from him. And then what happens after that? Judgment. God hands them over to their enemies. What happens after that? They repent. They cry out to God and say, oh no, it's all gone horribly wrong because we didn't trust you. And what does God do? He sends a saviour known as a judge who will save them from his people. And that leads to a time of peace. And then it starts all over again. Now, you can see that in Judges 2. But actually, if you want to go home and read the rest of the book of Judges, that happens again and again and again. The book of Judges is just this cycle of everything's fine. The people turn away from God. He hands them over to their enemies, one of the local other tribes nearby. They then say, oh no, sorry God, we've got it all wrong. So he sends a judge to save them. And then it all starts all over again. So, the book of Judges is just simply this rebellious spiral. However, two very interesting patterns to notice in the book of Judges. I'm wondering whether I might do a sermon series in the book of Judges, because it is such a bizarre but interesting book. One by one, the judges actually get morally worse. So bit by bit, they're supposed to be these great leaders, and they might have supernatural strength, but morally they get worse and worse people. But at the same time, they get, as far as the New Testament is concerned, they get more and more like Jesus. What do I mean by that? They get worse and worse, but the worse they are, the more times they are quoted in the New Testament some way about Jesus. Samson is the worst judge morally, and yet he's the one that there are most allusions in the New Testament that Jesus somehow fulfills some prophecy he made. It's really strange. I don't have time to unpack it, but I suppose what that teaches us is about the incarnation, that actually when God sends saviors, he sends people into the dirt and the muck who actually take on all that's wrong and save us. But I don't have really time for that. Maybe you've got some questions about that. End of Judges. You want to turn to Judges 21, verse 25. There's this spiral. It's all going wrong. Does someone want to read that and then tell me what does the writer of the book of Judges think is going to be the answer to this problem of all going wrong? Somebody want to read Judges chapter 21, verse 25, and then tell me what do you think the answer is they're expecting?
In those days Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit.
Thanks, Roger. So, what do they think the answer is? A king. Yeah. So clearly you've got this spiral. It's going round and round. It's all going horribly wrong. And obviously the person who wrote Judges thought, well, the answer is going to be a king. When we've got a king, everybody's going to do the right thing. So that's what they're looking for. The book of Judges is looking forward to a king. And next week we'll think about that a bit more. So the story so far, Joshua and Judges. We've now got God's people who came out of Egypt. They're now living in God's place, but they're not under God's rule. We can't say they're actually living the way God wants them to. And they're waiting for God's king. Now that's a whole lot of content I've gone through really quickly. As I say, there's various questions. If you want to follow up more, read this in this sort of pink, salmon-coloured little leaflet. But to simulate some discussion, why don't you just chat in your tables for a couple of minutes about that quick overview? Did anything strike you as being really important? Have you got any questions? And there'll be quick time for questions, and then we'll move on to communion and the next stage. So, just a couple of minutes in your groups. What do you make of Joshua and Judges? What questions have you got? And we'll see how we get on.